Wow, this is great. I'm George Hudson, and I'm an alcoholic. And I like to thank Milton for asking me to come up here. I had a week of vacation left, and I said that'd be a perfect opportunity to use it. And so I had all these great plans for this week. And all before left Thursday morning to come up here. And then last Friday I had a flat tire, and then my son ended up was in a wreck and totaled his car on Sunday morning, and you know, I had 2 days to try to find him a new car before I left town and all. And I thought back to what my sponsor told me one time when I was, one of the first times I had car trouble and all. And I called him up, you know, whining and complaining and all. And I telling him about it. And he says, you know, we're the only people in the world that turn a mechanical problem into an emotional problem. And, I understand that. You know, that's kind of the way everything's an emotional problem to me. I found these things, it's great, we laugh and all to, about the things that we did. But see, the one thing that I try to remember, even though I laugh and I make fun of a lot of serious topics in my home group, the Winchester group in Memphis, there's one thing, we're about a very serious business and all. And some of us in this room will drink again. That's the nature of what we're dealing with and all. And, I don't want any of us to have to go to those lengths again. When I got here, I had a good job. I was making about $70,000 a year, and I was living in a car. Now, the unmanageability was kind of obvious. And, but it took a lot. I'm telling you, it took a lot to accept my powerlessness and all. And I was thinking, this being here today on a Sunday morning in these mountains is just a wonderful thing. I took care of my mother for the last 7 years of her life and all. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that opportunity by being sober. If I hadn't been sober, I'd never been able to do it. And when I was born, she wanted me, her goal for me, she wanted me to be the next Billy Graham. And my dad wanted me to be the next Mickey Mantle. Well, I came closer to what my dad, wanted than my mother. This would really, this really honors her and all, See, there's a lot of things I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous that, in the beginning, I about killed myself just believing everything I heard in AA. We hear some crazy things in AA. And I want to let you know, AA did not get me sober. AA does not keep me sober. God got me sober. God keeps me sober. And AA keeps reminding me of that. See, that's what I found a power, and that's what I'm supposed to be doing up here this morning. Page 29 says, in our own personal stories, each individual tells how he got this relationship with God. And that's what I'm going to try to do this morning. See, I ran from God for so many years and I couldn't run anymore. And one of the best dissertations of that, I usually don't talk about this other book very much, but I want to share something that a man named Paul wrote to a group at Rome. And in the 7th chapter, he said, I can't believe myself at all, because the things I want to do, I can't do. And the things that I hate to do, I continue to do. And I understood that. And then later on, he said, oh, wretched man that I am, who will relieve me of this state? A program called Alcoholics Anonymous, a way of life based on spiritual principles that allows me to live at peace with you and my fellow man today. See, all the things that I did for so many years, I always wake up and I'd think, I'd say, oh God, why did I do this again? My best thinking did not get me here. I had a lot of good thoughts followed by some pretty crappy actions. I knew what I was supposed to do, but I couldn't do it. And I went on and I went on, and I ended up dying of a disease called alcoholism. Alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. And it'll kill me if I don't do anything about it. And I didn't do anything about it because I didn't know I had it. But there's one thing I knew I had. I didn't feel at ease with myself. And this is great here this morning. Mary, that was a great talk Friday night, and Laura yesterday, and Devereaux, who happens to be my grand sponsor. I better say something about him, or he'll jump on my sponsor, and then he'll jump on me, and all. And so, and then Bill was my first sponsor when I first got sober for the first 2 years, so he heard my first fifth step, so he knows quite a bit about me. And all, and you know, there's a lot of old friends and a lot of new ones here this morning. And all, but you know, it just amazes me, because see, I wasn't in very much demand when I got here. You know, the only place I was wanted was in circuit and criminal courts. I was going through an 8th DWI, and I was a year into the divorce. I was going through the same divorce that I was going through the second time I came to AA. You know, only lasted about a year that last time. You know, I was just like Bill. It took 3 times for me, just like Bill did, to get sober. And all. And my sobriety date, by the way, is August 3rd of 1998. And I've had 4 powerful spiritual experiences in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first one was the one that got me here. You know, I was living in that car, and 2 days before I walked into that last treatment center, I woke up that morning and I just yelled out, "God, I can't do this anymore, and if you'll get me back to AA, I'll never leave again." And I called that treatment center because I knew I was physically addicted to alcohol at that time. And during that time, I called them up, and they said, "Come in first thing Monday morning." This was August 1st. And I thought, oh, no, I got to drink for 2 more days. So I got into on the way to pick up a few things before I got to a hotel room to stay those last 2 days, I got arrested one more time for driving on a revoked license. And so I got into a hotel room, and I stayed there for those 2 days, and I maintenance drank for 2 days. That Saturday night, I poured out a whole half gallon of vodka. I knew the gig was up. You know, I quit drinking and came to AA. I didn't come to AA to quit drinking. And I got up there, and during that time, you know, I just thought my life was over. You know, I didn't know what. But see, I had surrendered. And then that Monday morning, I walked into that last treatment center, and I went through alcohol withdrawals for several days. And when I walked out of that treatment center, I did something that I'd never done before. You know, I'd always left treatment centers before and drank. I went to visit a friend of mine who just happens to be a minister. And we prayed together, and something went away. And he told me, after we prayed together, he told me, you know, something that I've never heard hardly any minister say. And this one, you know, he's not your typical minister. You know, he had been to open AA meetings. He'd gone to Al-Anon. He was familiar with our program. And he told me something. He says, "Don't come back to church for at least a year." You know, he said, church can be confusing to new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and I understood that. He said something too. He said, "You may be the villain of your family now, but if you do the things that you're told to do in there, you will become the hero." And today I have a great relationship with my kids. I have a fair relationship with my ex-wife. And now I also have a fair relationship with my husband-in-law. And, you know, I, You know, that's kind of iffy too. But see, that's the thing that the work in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to do. And see, I didn't start out this way. See, I came from a good Christian home. And a lot of times people say in AA, they'll say, yeah, a good Christian home, great breeding ground for alcoholism. Well, I don't agree with that. You know, I believe being raised in that good Christian home, that later on when alcohol took me to my knees, it gave me something to build a recovery program around. You know, the principles and values that later on, that's what destroyed me anyway. You know, the guilt, shame, and remorse of the things I was doing that I couldn't stop doing and all. And I remember, you know, the times when I was a kid and all. And I, you know, but there was something wrong with me, see. There was no alcoholism in my family. But for some reason, at a very young age, before I ever took a drink, I became obsessed with alcohol. And Dr. Silkworth talks about we have this mental obsession followed by the physical craving of that's what makes us an alcoholic. And in there, you know, when I was about 6 years old, you know, I fell in love. I was about 1960, and, you know, and I used to watch the game of the week with Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese, and they would, you know, Diz was drinking that Falstaff, and man, I loved it. You know, that was just right down my alley. And my mother and I went to the store one day, and I ran over to the beer cooler, and I grabbed a quart of Falstaff, and I ran back to the car, and she says, take that and put that back. And I went running back over there, and I tripped and fell and broke that quart of beer on the floor. Well, she had to pay for that quart of beer, and I had to pay with something else when I got home. And all, and you know, and it just went on like that. And showing you the, you know, it's not the crazy things that I did, but it was the crazy thinking that went around it for all those years. You know, when I was about in seventh or eighth grade at church, we had this, I'm a alcoholic. But we had this recovering heroin addict that came to talk to us at church. And I grew up in this Baptist church. And all. And you know what? You know, everybody loved him. They thought he was great and everything. I said, man, I'd like to be a recovering heroin addict. You know? Yeah. That's, you know, and I was thinking, I says, you know, I don't like drinking, but, you know, maybe I can become a, you know, that's, not many people aspire to be a recovering heroin addict. And all. But, you know, there was something, you know, and I didn't want to drink because back at that time in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, if you drank, that was being redneck. You know, and I wanted to be that other thing. But for some reason, alcohol just did what I needed. You know, I believe I was born a half a pint loaf. You know. And, you know, and when I drank that half pint, I was whole. See? But when you put too much of a substance in an engine, what happens? It burns up. That's what happened to me. And, you know, and I went on, and during those years, and, you know, and the other crazy thinking as a teenager, first two times I got drunk, I drank bourbon. First time was on a church camp out, of all things. We had Jim Beam and Hawaiian Punch. And, you know, not a very good mixture. But you know, I drank that, and I threw up. Second time, I drank some Old Charter, and I threw up. And, you know, if you'd think if I was normal, I would think, you know, drinking's not for me. The thought came in my head. I said, I got to find something that I can drink that won't make me throw up. You know, that's the way I did. You know, I'm looking for a solution the whole time. You know, and then I entered my wino stage, and then my beer stage, and all. And then I got my job when I was 21 years old at the railroad. I still have that job today. I couldn't hold that job anywhere else. You know, they'd have run me off. Been there for 35 years. And the first day on the job, an hour and a half into my first day, man I was working with said, how fast can you drink a beer? I said, I don't know. See, before I went out there, my daddy worked there, and he warned me. He says, son, you're going to see and hear a lot of things out there, but you don't have to do everything you see everybody else do. See, he knew when it went on out there. But, you know, not me. You know, I'm going to try to fit in wherever I go. So we went down to these ice machines. And this man dug out two beers out of my cooler. I was popping my top, and he was crushing his can. And I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be a great job. You know, man, you know, I fell in love with it. But see, I could still control it at that time a little bit. I wasn't that bad yet. But I still had the crazy thinking. And then I went on, and I got transferred to Springfield, Missouri. And I crossed the line about the time I crossed the state line into Missouri. You know, here I was, 22 years old, moving off to a new place, having to take responsibility that everybody else has to take, get a home, you know, pay bills, you know, go work in a new place. And alcohol became my best friend to handle all the fear I was going through. And from that day forward until the day I got sober, I drank every day except for when I was locked up in a jail or a treatment facility. And that's just what I did, you know. In about 1978, I was standing in my living room and I said to myself, self, you got to drink every day. But see, I wasn't going to come to AA. You know, the people that I drank with at that time started showing up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That time, Earl's good friend, Gary Chapman, when, you know, me and him drank together. He got sober 18 years before I did. And I was grateful when I came in, Gary asked me right outside a meeting and everything. You know, see, the third time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it took him saying this at one of the very first meetings I went to help me see everything. He asked me, he said, why did you drink that last time? And, you know, I knew enough about AA to be dangerous. And I said, all my anger and resentments. Oh, my partial's coming out. he says, bull, you drank because you wanted to. And I thought, you know, he's right. I drank because I wanted to. And it wasn't until I didn't want to and I surrendered that things began to change. And then I went on, and, you know, I started showing up in jails. I got four DWIs in Springfield. And then I moved back to Memphis, think things are going to be all right. And then boom, boom, I got two more. And that sixth one was just bizarre. You know. You know, we don't have, you know, alcoholics, you know, Bill says, you know, we do tragic, disgusting, terrible things when drinking. Well, he left out one word, bizarre. You know, because, you know, I was at my home bar. You know, I have a home group today, but I had a home bar back then. You know, that's where you really, you know, they got your drink sitting for you on the counter when you walk in. They made me an honorary old fart at that bar. And I thought, you know, I had arrived. And I was in my 20s I got up there, and I left that bar one night after drinking about 20 screwdrivers. And I got up there, and I was, just drove by my street, and I was thinking, you know, I need to go home. I think I'll go to Taco Bell. And so I'm on my way to drive to Taco Bell, and I about run somebody off the road. And it, you know what this guy does? He turns around and comes after me, going to make a citizen's arrest. I thought, here's Gomer Pyle coming after me, going to make a citizen's arrest. And I got up there, and I'm in the line at Taco Bell getting ready to order me about a half a dozen burritos or tacos or something. And he reaches in my car and takes my keys out. He says, I'm making a citizen's arrest. I think, you are? You know, so I just get out of my car and start walking home. Just leave it there in that drive-thru. A few minutes later, him and a cop come driving down the road. Here I am jogging down the road and all drunk, and they arrest me. And here's my sixth DWI. It's actually just my second in Tennessee, so I'm looking at 45 days in jail. But see, before that, you know, I got up there, and, you know, all the things that Bill said happened to me. You know, I went out, I, You know, I sought out to chase Jack Nicklaus, and liquor caught up with me before I caught up with Jack. And, you know, and all those things happened. And in, like Bill said, in 1929 when the stock market crashed, August 23rd, 1982, when I was working in Springfield, I walked in and I was cut off. My job was over with. I got called back a few years, but, you know, that was my stock market crash. And I stayed drunk for another 6 months or so before my great enabling mother sent me a little job posting about a job in Memphis, and I came back to Memphis. And all, and I love enablers, you know, not because they kept me out for so long, because they saved my life. You know, those enablers kept me from dying, probably. You know, I had such a resentment against my ex-wife when I got here, but today, you know, I think of her and all, and I'm grateful that she kept me alive for 14 years until I could find this place and could surrender to the disease of alcoholism. And I came in here and during that time that I was facing that 6 DWI, I got up there during that time, you know, I said, something's got to change here. So I was sitting there at my home bar one day, and a young lady walked in. I thought, I'm going to marry her. You know, I didn't think about, you know, what she wanted. You know, see, we don't get in relationships. We take hostages. And that's what I did, you know. You know, I didn't show up at work for 10 days. You know, I was stalking her. You know, she'd go to work, and I'd be circling around her house the whole time while she was working. And then when she'd show up, no, I'd be there at her front door. And she said, hey, what a coincidence. I just walked in. I thought, yeah, I know. And then we got engaged about 3 weeks later and then got married on, day before Easter in 1986. And I was still facing this DWI. And I got this attorney, and he told me, he says, if that guy don't show up at court, he says, then you won't have to, you know, they won't have no conviction. And so we go to court. My attorney don't have much to work on. We took it all the way to a jury trial. And then this guy shows up in court 2 years later. And so the jury deliberates for about 15 seconds. And I come back with a conviction and showing you the love that my dad had for me. See, outside that courtroom, he said to me, he said, son, I wish I could do the time for you. And you know what? I wish he could have too. You know, because I had a family to support. He was retired, you know. I all these things, you know, that's just the kind of person I am. You know, y'all have given me a life. You know, I'm not a very nice person. You know, I had no thoughts for you or yours or anything that belonged to the world. Only thoughts I had were directed at me. But there's one thing I never learned to do, and that's when I started violating my own principles and values. I couldn't live with myself. And I went on, and then in 1987, it came a really bad year. I had to come to AA for the first time. I got pulled out of service at my job and came to AA. And so I had to go to this treatment center called Methodist Outreach in Memphis. And they, you know, and so I got me a big book before I went. And I started reading up so I know what to say when I get there. And I went to treatment. Man, they elected me the chairman of the inside meetings when I was there. You know, you all see that big book now. It's got, you know, people right in there like in your annual in high school. Man, they thought I had it going on. Man, I was so bogus. God. And we got up there and it was amazing the things that, you know, I went in there. Now I left that treatment center and I had to start going to some meetings, you know. And I went to this meeting. It was a place called the Action Club. And they had this blackboard over here. And all had people's birthdays on it. And I walked over to that blackboard. I wrote my name down. I said, George H., 5 years. You know, I ain't been sober 5 hours. But it just looked like the thing to do at the time. So I put my name on there. And at the end of that year, you know, at the end of that month, you know, it's coming up on my birthday. I think, hey, you know, I better get out of here. You know, it's long enough to kind of, you know, we kind of hit and run as alcoholics, you know, kind of till we wear out our welcome, and that's what I did. And then we were going to get married, and, you know, here's another one of these bizarre things. You know, I was taking a shower. We were getting ready to go out for the night. I'd been drinking all day. And I get up there, and I fall out of the shower, hit my butt on the tank on the commode. It shatters that porcelain, water going everywhere, cuts my back all the way to my butt, all the way to my backbone. And I asked my wife-to-be, I said, come in here and look at this. And she comes in and she says, oh, my God, I can see your backbone. And so I put on a robe, and we go to the hospital and all, and, you know, and they had to, here's alcoholism. You know, they had to pump my stomach before they could operate on me. It took 2.5 hours in surgery. But when they pumped my stomach, it pumped all the alcohol out, and it sobered me up instantly. And I thought, if I had one of those stomach pumps, I could drink all I want, and when I need to get sober, I just pump it out and go on. The trouble with an alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. And, you know, now I went on. And then my son was born. See, I'm talking about all these good things, you know, and we laugh, you know, but I terrorize the family that I love the most. And why is it we terrorize the people we love most? Because they're the ones in the room with us. You know, when I get ready to terrorize somebody, I'm not going to go across town and terrorize Bob. It's the woman that's laying in the bed next to me. It's the kids that are across the hall. That's what I did. This is a family disease. And both of my kids, my son's 20 and my daughter's 23, before they ever had a drink, both of them were in treatment 3 times. They were in adolescent treatment centers 3 times. And then Matt was reminding me, he called my house one day, I was 7 or 8 years sober at the time. He called my house when my mother was still alive and to talk to me, and I wasn't there. She says, you're not one of those people from the bar, are you? You know, see, she still lived in terror, you know, of me drinking again, you know, years later. And so, you know, I understood and ended up having compassion to these people. You know, I look at people, you know, that still have resentments and all against me, and I'd think, how would I feel? How would I feel if I was in their shoes? And all. And when my daughter was born, right after she was born, 2 or 3 months later, my wife was at work, and I ran out of liquor, and I left her alone at home to go get a drink of alcohol. See, that's what I did. See, I was completely consumed by alcohol. And then we sold that house a few months later, and 3 weeks after we sold the house, it burnt down. That could have happened while I was gone. See, so these things were buried inside me. These things weren't buried dead, they were buried alive. And when I got sober, I had to look at these things. It's not pleasant to look at all those things. It takes years for some of them to come up. See, some of them still had to come up. See, if I knew I would be standing here in this room this morning talking to y'all, when I started drinking, I would have either kept notes or hired a secretary or something, because, you know, there's a lot that I still don't remember. You know, I didn't know. And then things really got bad in my life. Because, you know, Tony was talking the other night, our meeting on Thursday night, about his dad. And October 21st of 1992, I went to work one afternoon, and I got a call at work that my dad had had an accident. and all. And I'm, you know, be careful what you pray for, because I left work and I figured probably what had happened. He'd had a massive heart attack. And on the way, see, I prayed before I started drinking. I prayed while I was drinking, and I pray today. My prayer then was, God, help me, help him to be alive and so I can take care of him and tell him that I love him one more time. I had had 38 years to tell that man that I loved him. So if you got somebody you need to tell that you love, do it today. And all. See? But he gave me that opportunity with my mother. See, I didn't realize how God works. You know, he didn't honor that request, but he honored it down the road with allowing me to make amends to my mother. And my ninth step amends to those two wonderful people today. You know, the other day we went over to Hammer's and I bought some poinsettias to change on their graves. And in that vase on those graves are 12 medallions. I've put my medallion each year in that vase underneath those flowers. And that's my amends to those two wonderful people, you know, that gave up everything for me and my sister. You know, they were two, not unselfish, they were selfless people that did without so we could have. You know, when he died, you know, then things got bad in my life. Because I had reached a point in my drinking where, you know, that pop-off vodka didn't work anymore. You know, nothing was working. I had to go to oblivion because nothing else was working. And I went on, but I kept working. And then in 1997, I came into, you know, well before that, about 1994, 95, I said, you know, I can't control my drinking anymore, so maybe I can control the way I spend. So I bought this. I go to in the mail order at Sears, and I buy this beer cooler so I can have beer on tap in my house. And I get this beer company in a Bob truck to deliver kegs of beer to my house. You know, that's like a bull in a china shop. Now, and I paid $69.27 for a keg every 9 days. And all, and you know, my neighbor behind me one time, he saw him delivering, and he said, "You having a party?" I said, "Well, I didn't think." I said, yeah, I'm having a party. You know, it was a one-man party. And all, and then I came home from work one day in August. You know, I came into AA 3 times in August. My son was born in August. I was born in August. I got sued for divorce in August. You know, August is kind of a scary month for me. You know, I don't do August very well. And, you know, I kind of tiptoed through that month. And then, you know, she got up there and she came home from work one day and she said, "Pack your bags and get out." See, I believe that, you know, these people, you know, when they finally kick us out, it's when they finally realize there's nothing I can do to control this man. That's how other people surrender from us. And, you know, I don't make jokes about Al-Anons. I've been in Al-Anon for 6 years. My daughter came to me when she was 17. Well, before that, when I got sober, at 6 months sober, she filed a court order never to see me again. At 5 years sobriety, she got up there and she said, she came knocking on my front door and said, "Daddy, I'm ready to have a father and daughter relationship." And you know how this happened? By me getting out of the way and letting God handle these things in his time and not mine. I'd made no contact with her during those years. But, you know, see, I made a decision based on self that later put me in a position to be hurt. See, at 6 months sobriety, you know, I get up there, this is right before the trial. We were having a divorce trial, lasted three days. You know, I seek full custody of those two kids. Now, you know, the likelihood of a male alcoholic with 6 months sobriety getting custody of two kids is zero. Bill told me, he says, I don't think I'd do that if I was you. you can't tell me now. I had to learn the lessons the hard way. That's the only way I've ever learned anything, the hard way. When I surrendered and came in, I was facing a lot. We tell what I was like. Now what happened? Now what happened was, I was grateful that people didn't give me treatment center AA. They didn't tell me 90 meetings in 90 days. Because I said, I went to somebody one time and I said, I've been sober 90 days and my life ain't better. He says, your life ain't going to get better in 90 days. It might get better in 90 months, but it ain't going to get better in 90 days. And that's about how long it took. It took about 7.5 years for me to see light at the end of the tunnel. It wasn't easy. Wendy, hang on. I called Bill when I was 6 months sober, and I said, man, I had a day where nothing bad happened. He said, this too shall pass. it's a rough ride now, but, I'm hanging on now, never know when the next shoe's going to drop, but, I don't have to drown. From the time I surrendered and said that prayer that I say every day, God, I can't handle alcohol, I can't handle the alcohol problem, you can, you take care of it. And that I've said that prayer every day since I've been sober. And I came in here, and I went to jail when I got out of that treatment center, and I went to jail again this month of November of 1998. I was doing weekend time for the whole month. And then at 6 months, like I told you, my daughter wouldn't have anything to do with me. And then at a year and a half sober, I had to go to jail on my last DWI. Jail ain't fun, but it sure ain't fun when you're sober. Let me tell you that. When I was in jail in 1987, I was on the bunk with a man from that I see in AA now. He was on the bottom bunk, and I was on the top bunk. And he told me, he says, if I take a drink when I get out of here, I'm going straight to AA. And you know he did? He's been sober since July 5th of 1987. Now, he's only in his 40s now. He's a young man. I was 11 days shy of my 44th birthday when I got to AA. I could not drink another day. I had the thought of, what if I just make it to my birthday? And I said, no, I can't go one more day. This is it. I'm not the kind of person that can pick my sobriety date. My sobriety date was picked for me. And I went up there and, after I got out of jail, I was hoping that everything's going to get better in year number three. And then I found out I had this viral infection that I had to take this medicine called interferon for a whole year. And it makes you feel like you got the flu. Worst thing I did, alcoholic, it don't take much to scare us. I got up there and I looked it up on the website, on that WebMD, and it says if you're a recovering alcoholic, you need at least 2 years of sobriety. And I thought, I barely got that. And it says it causes severe anxiety and depression, and I thought, oh no. And then it says in some rare cases, some people contemplate suicide, and I thought, oh no, I'm going to kill myself. it wasn't an easy year. There was a lot of times I couldn't go to work, I couldn't go to meetings. But see, I've found a power greater than myself in my life, God, today. I found out I can't always be around this fellowship. This fellowship's a powerful thing, but I can always have a program with me. See, that, it's a dangerous thing to it. In the beginning, I'd probably the group was my higher power. But I found a higher power, and it was through the pain that I had that got there. That first spiritual experience brought me here. The second one I had was one day I was, You know, I started doing things that other people do. You know, I started, doing things for my kids. And my son was in about the second or third grade at the time, and I started going to things. I'd go have lunch with him at school once a week. And one day I left a morning meeting, and I went to that school. On the way to that school, I had this feeling come over me where, I was still facing all these consequences, but absolutely no fear at all. It was such a wonderful feeling. You know, to me, a spiritual experience is the absence of all fear. And I've only had that feeling two or three times, but it was absolutely wonderful. And, and I went and had lunch with him. I went home and went to bed because I was working night shift. And then I woke up and the fear was back, and I thought, ooh, thank God. You know, I couldn't handle that for too long. that was better than any drink I ever had. And all. And then the third one, when I did my first fifth step with Bill, I went home and all those fifth step promises came true in my life. You know, it was a feeling. I laid on that $10 couch that I bought at a garage sale, and all in this little apartment that I was living in at the time. And it was a feeling of complete contentment and all. And I was, I went through all these things. And, I was still facing consequences because, I did a lot. And then I ended up, after that, I had back surgeries through being in a wreck. I had a couple back surgeries. And, I get up there, I think AA and it'll think for you. See, I got up there and I had to go, I wasn't a drug addict, but before I'd had my first back surgery, they were going to do a myelogram on me. And before they do a myelogram, they give me a big shot of Demerol in my hip. And so I get up there, and man, I go there, and I come home, and I'm all drugged out, laying in bed. And I stagger over to my tape player, and I put on a tape of Franklin Williams and everything to listen to while I'm drugged out. I'm laying up there, and then Franklin's giving it to me, and all. And I thought, this is great. And so I told somebody, and they said, weren't you scared getting that Demerol? I said, no, if they gave me a shot of vodka in my hip, I might have been scared, but, that didn't scare me. And then I went on, and then I got involved in service work. You people are crazy, because y'all started electing me to things, So, I followed Devereaux today. I followed him as the intergroup chairman. He got out of there, and then they elected me to be chairman of the intergroup. I thought, man, these people are crazy, I found out something. I learned something about myself during all these times. You can't please AAs no matter what you do. I was getting phone calls, right and left about what I was doing wrong and everything. And then later on that year, I became program director of the Bluff City Fellowship, where I'm picking the speakers and all for the next year's thing. Man, I'm getting called right and left about, I'm doing this wrong. It's a real experience everybody needs. But I found out during this year, I always wanted a title. I like that, I think, chairman. But I don't like the responsibility that goes along with it, And I found out, I need to be in the background. That's more fun. I won't be that elder statesman. I won't be no bleeding deacon. I got up there, it's been in the last 2 years that I've gotten up there, and I've I had to finally get out of recovery. I am recovered. I had to be in recovery for a while, but eventually I had to get on with living life. AA is not a non-drinking program. It's a life-changing program. That, to me, is the furthest thing from what AA is. Alcohol is a spirit. It was a spiritual experience drinking. But it finally quit working. AA works just like drinking does. It just don't work as fast. I have found a way in these years of being sober to be somewhere between my second and third drink every day. Absolutely wonderful. And, you know, God has blessed me in so many ways and all. And, you know, I told you about those two experiences, and the fourth experience I had was just last year. I went to bed one night, and I woke up at 2:30 in the morning, and I heard that death rattle going in the other room. I don't know if you've ever been with anybody when they died, but my mother was in her last hours. And right before that, the day before, you know, I was in there in her room, and she sat up in that bed and started talking in a strange language. I'm not much on talking in tongues and everything, but she was drunk in the spirit. And it scared me. And when I heard that death rattle at 2:30 in the morning, I turned on the television and everything so I wouldn't hear it. I was scared. I'll admit it, I was scared. And then I prayed and said, asked God to give me the strength to go in there. And I went in there and I took one of the dining room chairs and I went in there in her bedroom and sat there next to her holding her hand. But I didn't tell you this. See, I spent those years, and it wasn't until the last 2 months before she died that I was able to tell her that I love her. See, I was not able to, I didn't really like my mother. God gave me a second chance to show the love that I never did show her and all. And I sat there and I could feel the presence of God in that room as she took her last breath. And as I was drunk at my dad's funeral 18 years ago at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, I was able to speak a few words at my mother's funeral. And I said some things that I'm going to say to you now. You see, that's some of us have been in this other program, and my dad said some things, a lot of things came back to me when I got sober. And he said when I joined this other program, one of the things he said was, when I was a boy, I played as a boy. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. It took me 44 years to put away childish things. And then I opened up a little, I found one of my mother's old church brochures from one Sunday morning. I opened it up, and it says, no one can serve two masters. How could I serve God when I was serving alcohol? See, alcohol had to get out of the way for me to be able to find God. And I seek God. See, all the things that I did, you know, it's a miracle, you know. God does not help those that help themselves. God helps those who admit they are helpless. And at that moment when I walked into AA for the last time, I was helpless. And, you know, and I want to close with this that I heard a man say one time, and I think it's appropriate on a day like this. You know, this has been a wonderful weekend. 2,000 years ago, when the Master was walking the hillsides on the mountains, he said something kind of neat. You know, he said, sufficient to the day is the evil thereof. For you people who don't know King James, that's live one day at a time. And while he was on that hillside, he was bringing solution to people's pain. That's why he came. And during that time, they were holding a big eating meeting, you know, on that hillside, and then there's this other man over in this other group. His name was John. He must have been a Baptist group because his name was John the Baptist. Well, old John got up the steering committee. You know, he was in jail, a position not unknown to too many of us, and he got up the steering committee. He said, go over and see about that master. See if he is the one to come or if there's another one to come. Go check out his credentials. See what he's made of. And so the steering committee goes over there and they ask him, they say, are you the one to come or there's another one to come? Where's your credentials? What are you doing? And he didn't get involved with preaching to them, he got involved with the time-tested crucible of results. He said, go and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard. Go and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard. The blind see, the deaf are raised. The sick are made well, the blind see. Go and tell what you have seen and what you have heard. When we leave here today, You know, here we got it in here. You know, jobs and careers are preserved. Families are maintained. The drugged are clean and the drunk are sober. Go and tell what you've seen and what you've heard. I thank you.